Okay, that's one of them old Cajun wars, you know, they used to play years ago. Might not sound good, but I'll play it to you anyway.
Vardis Connor with something he calls the Old Cajun Waltz. And welcome to Encore. This week is a special edition. We're going to be talking about Le Comte de Pascal with Barry Ancelet. And recently they did a backyard series, and that was the topic. And Mitch Reed was there as well. And it's just kind of to promote the upcoming backyard series, which will be this Tuesday night, talking about they'll be talking about cooking with beer, and it starts at 6:30 at Vermilionville, and it's brought to you by the Center for Louisiana Studies. And Barry, thanks for joining me today.
Sure, I always cook with beer.
Do you?
Sometimes I put some in the pot too.
Uh huh. Yeah. Well, I think that's the point. But
talk about cooking with beer. The stuff that we're talking about today, the Pascal stories. Mm-hmm. That was precisely the point for the context for a lot of those stories as well.
Yeah, there's one of the little snippets that I got that I grabbed off that CD that Jennifer gave me of y'all's interview. Mitch said he would go home and tell his mom about these stories that he would hear from his uncle, and she said, "Oh, you shouldn't go over there. He's always drunk," she said.
Well, you know, similarly, when I first ran into this tradition telling Pascal stories, mm-hmm. For some reason they ended up, or they were commonly called telling Pascal stories, and I ran into some people who were doing this because Reeven Reed, one of Mitch's uncles, was one somebody I was working with in Mamou to try to find storytellers and singers, and he was aware of this. But you know, he thought I was looking for fairy tales and legends and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And as time went by, you know, the net got wider and wider and wider. And I ran into some of these guys telling these stories in the bars in the morning in Mamou. In Mamou back then, on that one block stretch where Fred's still is, mm-hmm. between the Kazan Hotel and Fred's, mm-hmm. there were six bars on that one block. Mm-hmm. And so these guys would carom, you know, like a pinball machine. Mm-hmm. They would go from bar to bar, looking for each other to get enough people together to play cards.
Yeah.
And while they were visiting, they would tell these stories. And these stories were generated by real characters who had recently passed away. And so there was their way of keeping them around.
Mm-hmm.
And so they ended up, they started out telling stories about Pascal and Olid, and then a few other people came into this, you know, Jim Israel, Mayo Israel, and a few other people. As people would pass away, they would become part of the pantheon
mm-hmm.
of these stories. And as I was listening to the stories, what was amazing was that they were making them up as they went along. These were not retold stories.
Right.
They were inventing them as they were saying them. As a matter of fact, one of the most amazing stories they were all amazing, but one of the most elaborate stories I heard lasted about 20 minutes, and it was about how Jim Israel went to the moon in a runaway hay baler by accident and then got back through the North Pole and all kinds of crazy things. It was just the most amazing fantasy. And at the end of the story, Tutu Reed, Irving Reed, who had told the story, he was lying sick and in bed, and I had gone to visit him with Reven. And at the end of the story, Reven, his brother, said, "Damn, La Baloza Jim." That's the first time I hear that one. And Irving said, "Me too." And he had just told this thing. So it occurred to me as I was listening to these stories that they weren't just stories.
Mm-hmm.
They were a way of speaking. They were like a language. There was a grammar to it.
Mm-hmm.
And just like in, you know, grammar, not you can't document or have everything that is sayable, you know. But what you can have is the rules, the structural rules that would tell you how to say it.
Yeah.
And that's what they were playing with. They were playing with essentially what amounts to a grammar.
Mm-hmm.
They had certain characters and certain situations and certain strategies and certain things that people would do, and based on that little rule system, they would come up with these unbelievable stories.
Like a little math equation for stories.
Exactly, yeah.
That's amazing.
The first article I did, one of the first articles I wrote was about these Pascal storytellers. Mm-hmm. I called it "Talking Pascal," like talking French or talking English. And I dedicated it to the waitress at the Traveler's Cafe.
Oh, yes.
Who, when I went in to ask, and this is what you were talking about a while ago, when I went into, like, who was it? Mitch's mother, who said, don't go. I went into the Traveler's Cafe and I said, "Have you seen Hugh Breed? I'm looking for Hugh Breed," who was one of these storytellers. And she said, "You looking for him?" I said, "Well, yeah." She said,
Why?
I said, "Well, because I'm trying to, you know, connect with him. He's telling me stories." And she said, "Oh my God!" I said, "Why? What's the problem?" She said, "Well, when I see him come in through the front door, I go hide in the kitchen. I don't want to hear all that stuff, you know." And so she says, "What do you do? Who are you? What do you do?" And I said, "Oh, I work at the university." And she said, "Oh, that figures." So I dedicated the article, one of my first articles, to the waitress in the Traveler's Cafe, who to this very day never understood why somebody would be actively looking for somebody she tried to avoid every day.
Yeah, someone who spoke about nonsense nonstop.
Yeah, except that it wasn't just nonsense.
Yeah.
It was inspired, highly structured nonsense.
Yeah,
which is what Jules Verne was. All mm-hmm. fantasy writers. I mean, if these guys had figured out how to write down what they were, the stories they were telling, mm-hmm. they would have been science fiction writers or something, fantasy writers.
Cajun science fiction.
I mean, look at the kinds of stories. One of them was about going to Japan across the Pacific on a bicycle with overinflated tires. I mean, you know?
Yeah.
That's perfect cartoon fantasy type stuff.
Yeah. Well,
they could have worked at Hanna-Barbera. or Walt Disney.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it could have. Yeah. This next one is about, well, the first one we're going to listen to that I pulled is about giant mosquitoes hauling a caban across the Gulf of Mexico. So let's listen to that one, and then we'll talk a little bit more about it.
And Hubert went too, and we were waiting on the steps, yeah. Sitting on the steps outside, waiting to waiting for the dinner to be ready. And I was just sitting there talking to him, but nothing in particular. I did like this and killed a mosquito. I said, "Man, the mosquitoes are bad this year." He said, "Yeah, they're bad. Talk about they're bad." But he said, "It's not as bad as when I was a gauger in Cameron." It worked as apparently he did, and this is why he would start with the truth. Then he said, "I worked with a gauger in Cameron on the coast." He said, "A little bit of carbon, they would send me over there, and all I had to do they would leave me out there for 2 weeks at a time, and all I had to do was go check on the gauge every day, twice, three, four times a day, and there was nothing to do. It was so boring. It was a little bit of carbon. I was by myself." And he said, "One day, I heard this buzzing sound." He's like, "Man, what is that? It sounded like a plane or something coming." I look up, and there was a mosquito dive bombing me. He said it was coming from the west. It was some Texas mosquitoes. He said this thing was about 6 feet 5 inches long. It weighed about 280 pounds. It had a beak about this long, and it was dive. But I ran into the little cabin and I closed the doors and the windows, a little all wooden thing. And he said that it was coming so fast I couldn't stop. It beak. Beak came right through the wall. I said, "Man, look at that." And then next thing I know, there's another one. Bang! Comes to the other wall. And another one. Bow! And another one. There's four of them. And their beaks all sticking through the walls. And I said, "What am I going to do?" So he said, I didn't know what else to do. I grabbed a hammer and I nailed them all. I nailed them. I crimped them. And they couldn't get out, you know. And they were still buzzing. And man, after a while, I heard this kind of weird, far away sound, and I opened the door, almost fell out of my cabin. They had flown away with the cabin. We were way up in the clouds. I'm looking down thinking, "Oh my God," and we over the Gulf. And he said, "Man, I don't know how to swim either." So he said, "I didn't know how am I going to get down?" So I said, I took my hammer and I leaned out and I knocked one of them on the head and knocked him out. And he stopped flying, and the cabin started coming down. He said, "There's a difference between 4 mosquito power and 3 mosquito power." So I went on the other side, because I was kind of slipping. I went on the other side and knocked this one out, and it kind of balanced off, and it came down some more. And I went out and knocked on this one, and it came out, and we were hanging like this, and we were about 6-8 feet above the Gulf, and I can't swim. So he said, "I had to wait until we got to the beach, somewhere between Galveston and Beaumont." He said, "As soon as we hit the beach, I hit that other one, and it came down a perfect 4-point landing." Got out of that thing, and he said, "I ran. I don't know what happened to the mosquitoes, but I ran until I hit a highway." And he said, "Well, how am I going to get home? I have to hitchhike home." I got on the road, and Hube, the real Hube, did you remember this?
Yes.
He had thumbs that were dislocated or double jointed or something, and they went down real far. He said, "I got on the highway and nobody would pick me up." He said, "Look, I'm just like a turtle. I got 7 kinds of meat. I'm made up of 7 kinds of meat." He said, "Some people think I'm an Italian. Some people think I'm an Indian. Some people think I'm a Spanish. Some people think I'm," and nobody would pick me up. Nobody wanted to pick me up. And all those prejudiced drivers, nobody would pick me up. And he said, "Big trucks would go by, and it would make so much wind. Look what happened to my thumb." And he would. All that from the mosquitoes are bad.
It's amazing the elements, how realistic they are in those stories.
Oh, yeah, everything is precisely located and described. There's precision to this madness. By the way, did you hear Mitch laughing?
Yeah.
Well, you know, this is a story that Mitch had heard who knows how many times. It's still funny, you know?
It is. I love it. How many stories did you collect from them?
Nowhere near enough.
Yeah.
But, you know, the thing is, I would have had to been recording them
constantly,
pretty much live every day for 3 or 4 hours a day,
mm-hmm,
to catch everything, because they were constantly, constantly, constantly producing these things. It didn't take, you know, they didn't need a, they didn't do it because there was a microphone there.
Mm-hmm.
They just did it for themselves.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I collected maybe about 5 or 6 hours,
mm-hmm,
of this, but I could have collected 5,000 hours,
mm-hmm,
you know. I just cut the tip of the iceberg, and just enough to understand what was going on,
mm-hmm,
really.
Yeah.
Interestingly, this was based on, as I said earlier, a set of characters. Pascal was the central one. People would talk about telling Pascal stories, but he was nowhere near the only one. And it was apparently generated or initially referring to a real-life person who had been on the police force. And he apparently actually was tall and thin.
Mm-hmm. Pascal. But,
yeah. But in the story, of course, you know, he becomes taller and thinner. And everything is exaggerated.
Yeah.
So by the time he, you know, gets to the story, he's 6'5" and weighs 74 pounds. and then, you know, you express shock at such a person, and then the storyteller says, "Oh wait, il était fin comme une aiguille. He was as fine as a needle."
Yeah.
As which is one of the reasons why he could ride so fast on his bicycle, because he would cut through the wind.
Right.
He didn't have any wind resistance.
So for people who haven't heard this story yet, they wouldn't give him a car, or they didn't have enough money for a car.
Well, they one of his responsibilities apparently as as a police officer was to catch people who were speeding and thus, you know, threatening the gas ration, you know,
mm-hmm,
during. So his responsibility was to catch speeders, but they couldn't afford to give him a car. They could only afford to give him a bicycle.
Mm-hmm.
So he's got to catch speeding cars in a bicycle, which is one of the reasons why he had to figure out a way to be able to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the ways he did it was by taking the tires off of the bike. And he had just the rims. And he learned how to ride on the electrical lines. And he would see them coming from far away. And then as they were getting there, he would just come down and stop them. You know? But that didn't work so well because there weren't electric lines everywhere.
Yeah.
And so he ended up learning how to ride really fast. He apparently had a long pointed nose, too, which acted like a razor blade, kind of a windbreaker,
wind.
You know, lowered his wind resistance.
Mm-hmm.
And he got so fast that you couldn't see him.
Yeah.
Passing.
And how did they know he was coming?
Well, he lived south of Mamou, and his girlfriend lived in Riedel, which is north of Mamou.
Okay.
And so he had to pass through Mamou.
Mm-hmm.
But he had gotten to be so fast on that bicycle, couldn't see him,
mm-hmm,
pass. But he had a little basket on the front. And he had a little dog named Dele, who weighed 4 ounces, a little bitty dog. And the dog's girlfriend lived in Mamou. So,
the dog's girlfriend.
Yeah, the dog's girlfriend lived in Mamou. So as he was going through Mamou so fast nobody could see him, the dog would jump out of the basket to go visit his girlfriend.
Uh-huh.
And when the dog would appear, they knew that Pascal had just gone by.
That's good. 4 ounces.
I mean, we're talking about fantasy again.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
So the story about the mosquitoes, that was Hubert that told that story,
yeah,
huh?
I was reporting the story as Hubert, but
right.
I was reporting, it's easy for me, right? I have the story in my head.
Right.
Hube actually made that up on the spot because I swatted a mosquito on my arm.
And did he actually work out there?
I guess he did.
Okay.
Yeah, I guess he did. He did all kinds of things. He was a merchant marine. He was. He did all sorts of things in his life. He had,
mm-hmm,
a lot of experiences.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, you know, he says, I can't swim. He was a merchant marine. Of course he could swim.
Right. Yeah, well, the...
But it's...
Just to make the story better.
In his story, he needed to not be able to swim.
Yeah,
so he
just needed...
reinvented that.
To get home, he had to find he had to kill the mosquitoes down to 3-power.
Yeah, and he had a...
3-power mosquito.
He had a double-jointed thumb.
Mm-hmm.
And he would... When he was trying to hitchhike, you know, the wind from the trucks would push, and then he would show you as he's telling the story, he would disjoint his thumb and show you what the trucks did, the wind did to damage to his thumb.
So you recorded him and who else? How many men?
Irving Reed, his brother, mm-hmm. Reven, mm-hmm. Alexandre Manuel, Von Fontenot. There was a little group of the Shardy, I think Shardy was Fontenot. They would get together for suppers or for card games and stuff. There was mm-hmm. a little, you know, crew of people that would do this.
Right.
And, you know, they would get together like at Fred's, right, for example. Mm-hmm. With four or five of them. If they got a little critical mass going, it was all over.
Yeah.
I mean, they just took over whatever was happening around them, you know. And, you know, so they would show up, say, at Fred's or the Travelers or the Casanova Lounge or somewhere. And this would start. Well, it sort of took all the oxygen out of the room. Nothing else could happen in there for a while. So, yeah. You know, they had a great time. I'm not sure how great a time other people always had unless you were plugged into it, unless you enjoyed it, you know.
Yeah. Does this still happen in certain places?
You know what? I started thinking that it must happen in lots of places, you know, where storytellers know each other so well that they hang out together a lot. Mm-hmm. And so what happens is you develop a shorthand mm-hmm. of references. Mm-hmm. You settle on a cosmology. You know, characters and places and themes and stuff. And I'm sure it must happen in other places. I mean, I heard that there was a similar group operating in Youngsville, though I never could find them.
Oh.
But anyway, this bunch was really extraordinary. And, you know, maybe I found them kind of by accident.
Yeah. It's interesting. How did you... I mean, I know you said you went to the Travelers Lounge and talked to the waitress, but how had you heard of these storytellers anyway?
Reven told me. Working with Reven, and two of these storytellers were Reven's brothers.
Right, right.
And Reven was fascinated with this whole process, too. And
okay.
So he took me over to meet his brother Irving, who was ill at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when Irving told me the story about Jim Israel going to the moon.
Right.
And he told that story, by the way. Because Reven said, tell him the story about the time Pascal and Olid tried to go to the moon in a converted Ringer washing machine. And, of course, Irving wouldn't they did not retell stories.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if he even remembered what he'd come up with earlier,
yeah.
You know? So when Reven tried to prompt him to tell the story about Pascal and Olid going, and then something happened. It was a long story about that they had gotten all these prep. They would have been the first humans to make it to the moon just before the American astronauts went. But the moon set, and Olid had forgotten to pack a flashlight, and they never could find it in the dark, and they had to come back. That was basically the story. But when Reven tried to prompt Irving to tell this story that he had told Reven before—
uh-huh.
Irving would not tell that story. He came up with another moonshot.
Interesting. I feel like I've experienced this in my life, like someone talking to an older person who was a storyteller and kind of trying to jog their memory on what it was that they told the first time. I feel like I've heard that before. Like, I feel like this must still happen, you know?
Oh, I'm sure it does, yeah. My grandfather, Valerie Meyer, my mm-hmm. mother's father, was from Pacoyer between Leonville and Orneville, and he did this too. Mm-hmm. He would at Easter, I mean, when family was gathered at their house, he would just go sit on a bucket under a fig tree and start talking, mm-hmm. and within 10 minutes he had gathered a crowd, and he wasn't telling set stories. He was mm-hmm. just being funny, you know, off the top of his head.
Yeah.
And one time, my mother. Excuse me, my grandmother had gone to visit her family in Paconier and left my grandfather, her husband, with my mother and her siblings mm-hmm. in Lafayette. And my mother was a little late getting home from school. She was normally the one who would have cooked for him.
Right, okay.
And he said, you know, she said, oh, Daddy, I'm sorry, I forgot. I was supposed to hurry home. I forgot Mama wasn't here. I was supposed to cook for you. And he said, oh, don't worry, babe. I made something for myself. She said, what did you make? You know, he didn't cook. And what did you make? He said, oh, I stuffed some sweet peas. I made some stuffed sweet peas. I'm like, how do you stuff sweet peas? You know? And he was just funny like that, just off the top of his head.
Yeah.
So I think you're right. I think it happens a lot.
Yeah. That's not a trait I was born with, unfortunately.
Unfortunately, telling good stories. I was born with.
I'm pretty bad at it. People get bored and walk away when I try to tell stories. But,
well, it's a mixed blessing the other way. I mean, it is a gene I was born with, and sometimes I start talking and people walk away because they don't want to hear it.
Aww. Well, I had pulled another story, speaking of Hubert being a sea merchant, about a fruit boat.
Yeah.
But this one, I was asking if we should play it or not. I don't find it offensive, but I feel like some people might find it offensive because he uses a slanderous term. But I don't know if you want to use it or not, or if you want to explain maybe.
Well, the term, let's be upfront. The term is Dago, and you know, it was a disparaging reference for Italians, especially early on when, as they were coming into New Orleans, and they were referred to. But for better or worse, the term didn't have negative value for Cajun French speakers. It was just what it's kind of like Cajun or you know, Creole. It was
right.
Something that, you know, these people are called that. As a matter of fact, there are other terms that are, you know, considered disparaging now, reference to Italians, that while I was growing up in the 1950s and 60s in Lafayette was completely neutral. Don's Seafood restaurant here in Lafayette used to feature on its menu an Italian salad that was identified on the menu as a wop salad.
So, interesting.
You know, yeah, and we didn't know better. We didn't know it was a bad term. So anyway, this story it refers to Dagos, but you know, you remember that Jure song?
Yes.
Let Dagos onto my lad.
Yes.
Yeah. So it, you know, there was no negative value ascribed to it. So if we can ask our listeners to understand it in that term, in that way, maybe we can hear the story. This is about an Italian fruit vendor who ends up getting swallowed by a live fish, like 'cause Jonah and the whale.
Right. All right.
Unbelievable. It really was unbelievable.
Yeah. Yeah, they love to tell stories about the Gulf of Mexico. That was like, that was a big thing, you know, because I remember he told me a story one time. He said, did I ever tell you? He said, one time I had to work on a fruit boat, you called that, in the Caribbean. And he said, we had all kind of bananas and papayas and coconuts on this little boat that I was on. And they had a whale. Her, she come, and she fall in love with my little boat. And she thought it was a male. And she was in heat. And she tried to breed with my little boat, and we thought she was going to flip the boat, so we didn't know what to do. So we threw all the bananas, all the papayas, all the coconuts, and that whale, her, she ate all the fruit. And but she still kept coming and trying to rub against the boat. So the captain, him, we didn't know what to do. We had a little bench and a little stool where we drank our coffee. We threw the little bench, she swallowed the little bench. We threw the little stool, she swallowed the little stool. So the captain, him, he scratched his head. He didn't know what to do. He said, well, we're going to have to start throwing the crew. And you bet said, we had a little Dago on board. He's about that high. We said, well, we got to throw the crew. He said, Dago, you first. He said, me, okay. So we grabbed that little Dago, we threw him in the Gulf, and that whale, her, she came and she swallowed the little Dago, and she died after that. And her body washed up in Bayou Lafourche, in Golden Meadow over there. And you talk about something, they went to cut that whale's belly open, and you're not going to believe what they found in there. There was a little Dago sitting on a little bench and a little stool. And he had some bananas. He said, 3 bananas for 5 cents. He had opened a fruit stand in that whale's belly.
tu malade, tu couché dans les grandes fossés. Balance tu pourri, couché côté le vieux dégo. Eh mon dieu, quoi il a? Dégo sans tu malade, tu couché dans les grandes fossés. C'est là-bas dans les magasins, à pousser les bananes sont tout pourries, t'es couché dans les grandes fossés. Des gars, quoi il a, oh des gars, quoi il a, des gars sont tout malades, couché dans les grandes fossés. Galoper dans les magasins, juste pousser des vieux bananes, les bananes sont tout pourries, t'es couché dans les dégos. Ego quaina, ego sans tu mala, tu couches dans les grandes fossés. Banane sans tu pourri, qui se côté le vieux dégo. Ah, mon vieux dégo, quaina, 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 quaina avec les dégo. Les dégo sans tu mala, tu couches dans les grandes fossés. Banane sans tu pourri, qui se côté le vieux dégo. Dego, 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 quaina, dego sans tu mala, tu couche dans les grandes fossés, couche, couche, le dego, dego, quaina, quaina, avec le dego. Quaina, avec ma femme, elle est malade, couche, couche, le vieux dego. Dego, dale cosa pa sale, quaina, ma chara mi, quaina, dale cosa pa sale, oi ai, o manek, dale cosa pa sale, pa mi la vian, pa mi anie, jit dale cosa na shodia, dale cosa pa sale, o manek, dale cosa pa sale, hi there.
People who had real characteristics. You know, they were farmers. Like Jim Israel was actually a farmer, and so they would take off from there and then spin it out of control. Mayo, his brother, actually worked for Mama Waterworks, so he was the guy who was making water. Pascal actually was a policeman. So, it would start with a kernel of truth, and then explode out from there. And what was interesting was the extent. There was apparently a vieille tante. There really was a woman who was a healer, a traiteuse, yeah. And of course they spun that out of control too. But what was interesting was the extent to which they were able to, on the one hand, maintain such a complex cast of characters, you know, and they would act in character, right. You recognize them the way they acted. And the other thing was that, all of these stories that I'm telling you, they never retold a story. We're retelling them, but they didn't retell them. They would, if you asked them to retell a story, they would ignore you and tell another one. Because for them, the challenge was, can I pull this off? Right. Can I just, right in front of here, right in front of everybody, God and everybody, can I spin one?
I think too one of the things that, you know, it's hard for me and Barry to recreate this, but Barry had kind of touched on this, is that when they would tell these stories, they always had a little friend that was next to them, like Torchon or somebody. And you know, Tutu might say, "Well, La Vieille Tante, you know, she had the first airplane that came out," and Torchon said, "They didn't have no airplanes in them days."
He said, "But I had the first one." That's right. They didn't have no airplanes before, but they had the first one.
Right.
And it was a crop dust, I believe.
That's right.
This would happen in dialogue, you know. And it would give the appearance of confirming this outrageous thing the other person said.
Yeah. It would kind of fuel the storyteller, you know, but question him.
That bull had horns. It would take a sparrow 15 minutes to fly from one tip to the other. And Hube would say, "We timed it one time. It was 16 minutes and 32 seconds, exactly." And it would give the appearance of confirming this. Right.
Yeah, they were amazing. I mean, but the greatest thing is, you know, you could go to Hubert's house, and Barry, I'm sure, did this, and you could say, whatever was on the news, you know, if it was something about politics or whatever. And I remember...
my brother had gone over there, and this was when Gorbachev, they had that coup, you know, and Gorbachev had disappeared, and it was on TV, and Hubert just stopped talking, and he listened to the news, and they were saying Gorbachev had disappeared, and he said, "Uh-huh, you see that?" He said, "Gorbachev, you don't want to be a communist no more." But he said, "Me, Hubert Reed, I'm a communist. I'm a communist, and I'm a bum, and I'm a hobo." But he said, "Next year, I'm going to retire from all three." And then he said, "And then I'm going to become a tramp." Uh-huh. "And I'm going to trample the world." And then he said, "And then after that, I'm going to the moon in my Mickey Mouse balloon." So, I mean, he would just go from one thing. You could walk in his house and you could say, "Hubert, you know, what's that planet called? The planet with the rings around it? Saturn?" He would take off from there. Oh, yeah.
He'd tell you how the rings got there.
He'd tell you how the rings got there. That's exactly right.
One time he said, "You out of toothpicks?" And he said, "Oh, you know why?" I mean, they were making a picket fence, and they couldn't find a regular saw, so they were using a chainsaw to make the pickets, and they messed up all the pickets, but they ended up making a bunch of toothpicks. And they opened a toothpick factory in Mamou for a little while. And he used to get my toothpicks free, but he said, "I can't get them free no more, and I refuse to buy them. That's how come I'm out."
That's how come I'm out.
There was an explanation for everything.
And if you're just joining us here on Encore, we've got Barry Ancelet in the studio. We were talking about talking Pascal, Le Conte de Pascal. And we're talking about this to promote the upcoming Backyard Series. This is a topic that they did previously in the last months. But this Tuesday night at 6:30 at Vermilionville, they will be doing the last Backyard Series for the year. And it will be on cooking with beer. And it's appropriate because, as Barry was stating before, beer was always relevant in this with this storytelling.
It was part of the fuel.
Yeah, part of the fuel. So we heard the story about the Pueblo Dago being eaten by the whale, and we listened to Wilfred Charles singing a jurde called Dago.
Which, by the way, was the first known recording of the term Zydeco, Le Zydeco Pasale.
Yep. Very interesting.
It was recorded by Alan Lomax in 1934 in New Iberia.
Yep. So we're just talking about storytelling and storytellers and everything that accompanies that.
I tell you, I consider myself so fortunate to have accidentally stumbled into that community. How many people, you know, have a chance to wander into such a rich, creative, crazy, but remarkably creative tradition. I mean, I had access to, you know, some Hollywood studio or something where they were coming up with all these stories, you know?
Yeah. That's amazing.
And one regret is that, you know, we didn't capture more of them. Another regret is that, you know, these guys didn't capture more of their own stories. Look, if they'd written them down or something. But a lot of it had to do with the immediacy of orality, you know, the challenge of coming up with one of these stories in real time, mm-hmm. orally, where you can't wait, you know, 15 minutes to come up with the next idea. You have to have it running in your head.
Right.
Because people are listening. People are consuming the story, and they won't put up with you. One of the interesting things, too, is that, as Mitch just pointed out, these things happened in dialogue.
Right.
A lot of times. You had one guy who would sort of get the floor, but there were two or three other people whose roles at that point would be to ask questions or challenge or say, "Wait a minute, was it really 15 minutes or was it 16 minutes? I think we timed it." You know, it was just pretending to go along with this and asking questions that gave the illusion of challenging it. But in fact, what it did was it gave the storyteller an opportunity to confirm it.
Right.
So part of the the expertise that was involved was not only the story, the guy who was spinning the story, but the other people who had a role in asking appropriate questions.
Right.
Like asking pregnant questions.
It's like a hype man.
Yeah, yeah, right. And sometimes Hugh would get the floor, and Alexandre Manuel would start doing that.
Mm-hmm.
And then Alexandre would get the floor, and Hugh would do it. So they all played all the roles.
Yeah. That's good. That's fun. Well, we can listen to a couple more that I have recorded. And I also wanted to mention that Mitch Reed is also on these recordings from the last one, along with Barry Osalay, just in case anybody was just joining us. And
here's what happened. Mitch knew about this tradition because these were his uncles and great uncles, right?
Right.
And I had recorded them back in the 70s. So Mitch and I, every once, we discovered that each other knew about these things. And it was fascinating how many people walking the planet had that much experience with these people, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so when we'd meet each other, we'd say, oh, you know, you remember, and have these stories about Pascal storytelling. And we would meet each other he started playing with Beausoleil. And was traveling a lot. We'd meet in the airport or something, you know, like in Atlanta or somewhere, and we'd start telling these stories. And next thing you know, the whole band was listening. So I told Mitch, I said, we need to stop doing this by accident and start do it at least one or two times on purpose.
Yeah, yeah.
And this is how this backyard thing came about.
Interesting. That's really cool. Well, they also, speaking of like that running in Mitch's family, it really influenced Mitch's music as well. They made more than one of just they wrote Pascal's Aigrettes, but they also wrote a reel about Torchon.
Mm-hmm.
Is that correct?
Yeah,
I saw that.
And they wrote one about the holiday,
right?
Which is where a lot of this
Manuel,
stuff happened.
Yeah, yeah. Alexandre Manuel. Yeah, that's awesome. I love that. Well, I have a couple more that we can listen to, or if you would like, if you're prepared to tell one, you can. One of your favorite ones, if you have a couple memorized.
Memorized? No.
No.
but I can reconstitute one.
Yeah.
But let's listen to one from there.
They had a...
Especially if you have Mitch telling one, I'd love to hear him tell the story.
I've got a really short one about a tiger cat. And some popcorn, and then you come in with a duck. But then there's one about Fido.
A tiger cat and some popcorn, and I come in with a duck. Well, there's a recipe.
Yeah. We've got that one. We can listen to that one, and then we'll listen to a little bit of the Fido one.
Okay.
And so here's Mitch and Barry.
I'm going to get out of this one, and he always managed to do that. I remember he told me one time, and I'd go tell my mother the stories that he'd tell me, and she'd say, stay away from him. He's always drunk. She said, don't even go by him. Go sit with Mama on that chair over there.
And, of course, we're immediately drawn to it, right?
Exactly. Yeah, he told me, he said, I caught a catfish. I never forget when I was a little boy. He was always catching fish. I caught a catfish the other day. He said, you talk about holla. Me, meow, me, meow. He said, and then come to find out, he said, he was not a catfish at all. He said he was a tiger cat. And that fish come from India. Yeah, he said he swam all the way from India and came all the way to the bayou. He swam through the Bayou Cocodra and came to Mamou. And I'm sorry, it was just one thing after another. I was like, okay. So I'd go tell my mother that, and she was like, stay away from him. That's the best thing you could do. But he told me this one story that I really liked a lot. It just always stuck with me. But he said, one time, he said, your grandpa, him, he said he was plowing his popcorn. And he had a mule, and it was that mule, you know, and he died, him. And I said, well, how'd the mule die? Well, I'm going to tell you. He said he was plowing his popcorn, and he said it got so hot. It was so hot. It was in August. And he said the popcorn started popping in the field.
On the plant.
Yeah. And the horse, him, he thought it was some snow. He froze to death right there. So I just always something.
Okay, one time he said he had gotten some ducks. He was raising some ducks. And to save a little money, every day he would let the ducks out, and they would go eat some acorns. Mm-hmm. And then every night he would lock them up. And every night when he'd lock them up, he would notice there was one or two missing. You know, the raccoons or animals would catch them and eat them, you know. Mm-hmm. And he said, one day I locked up my ducks, there wasn't one left. Chew on that a while.
But you know, I like this one. He had told me one time, he said, he was always talking about my grandfather. My grandfather had passed away, and I didn't, he died when I was about 4 years old. I didn't really know him. They call him Simpson. And he said, you know, they call him Son, actually was his nickname, Son. And he said, you know, Son, him, he left us a long time ago. He went to Mexico. He went to over there on a trip, he said, and he took off. He was gone for about 3 months. And he said when he came back, he had a servant waiting for him at the train depot. And he got in the buggy. You know, his servant had the buggy. He said, well, servant, he said, how's everything been in Mamu on the farm since I've been away? And the servant said, oh, man, pretty good. Everything's good. And they kept riding, you know. And they got, you know, by Lance Meg. And he said, oh, yeah. He said, one thing happened. He said, Fido died. He said, Fido, my dog? He said, yeah, he died. He said, man, what killed him? He said, well, we figured. We're pretty sure now that he ate too much burnt mule meat when the mule was in the barn, and then the barn burned down.
But everything is okay other than that.
Oh, yeah, oh, yeah. He said, the barn burned down. He said, oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, I forgot to tell you that. He said, the barn burned. He said, man, how'd the barn catch on fire? He said, well, we figured. We think it came from the house. He said, but the house burned down. He said, yeah, the house is gone.
But other than that, everything is fine.
Oh, yeah, everything's good. Fido died. But he said, well, how'd the house catch on fire? He said, well, he said, we figured. He said, we're pretty sure now that it started when we had to light that miserable little candle that we had to put over the coffin of your mother-in-law that was dead. He said, my mother-in-law is dead. He said, yeah.
But everything, other than that, everything's fine.
Yeah, oh, yeah. He said, he said, how my mother-in-law died? He said, well, we figured, we're pretty sure now that she caught herself a heart attack. Heart attack? He said, yeah, she caught herself a heart attack when your wife heard she left with another man. And then he said, then your grandpa, him, he just cried after that because she didn't send not a postcard or nothing.
There you go. But other than that, everything is fine.
Yeah. But he was sad about Fido. That was pretty heavy.
Fido was the one.
So that's a little example of dialogue and feeding off of each other in a storytelling situation, Mitch and Barry there.
We see, it occurred to me as we were sitting there that Mitch had heard that story in dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
And there was somebody who was saying, yeah, but everything, other than that, everything was fine. I mean, he was doing one role, and it occurred to me, oh, he needs me to do the other thing.
Right. It's good stuff. Well, we got about 11, 12 minutes left in the show. So thank you for joining me today, Barry.
We didn't even talk about the bicycle yet.
We didn't. You want to tell it?
Well, you know, the bicycle was an important thing. And, you know, we already talked about how he got to Japan that time.
Right, with the overinflated tires.
Over the overinflated tires. You know how that happened?
No.
Well, you can't just do it on overinflated tires. You had to have a lot of speed. And so he tried a couple of times, and he couldn't generate enough speed by himself. So he finally figured it out. He got to the top of the Sierra Madre, the mountains,
uh-huh,
just off the coast in California, got to the top, uh-huh, and he had a ramp,
It made him a ramp. And it built him up enough speed to where he was going fast enough. He was just skimming on the top.
Yeah.
And he would have made it all the way. He was going to visit his son who was stationed in Japan.
Uh-huh.
He would have made it all the way. But he ran into a whale. He bumped a whale. It didn't hurt the whale because the inflated tires was okay. So it's an environmentally correct story.
Yeah, yeah.
But when he bumped the whale, he started to sink. It didn't sink. The inflated tires kept it, but the bicycle fell upside down. And the metal part is underneath. That's where he's sitting. So he had to get up, and he got on top of one tire. And he figured, if I turn the tire, it's going to go. But he's running this way, right? He's running toward Japan.
Backward.
But the part is going back. So he's got to turn around and look back to America to run to go to Japan. You have to be very smart to figure that out. You have to run the wrong way to get the right way.
And did he get there?
He did get there. But he got stuck in the Philippines. And back then, there was only one Philippine.
Right.
It was one big island by itself. He was so mad when he got to that island, he found a cross-cut saw, and he cut that whole island in little bitty bits, and that's how come there's a bunch of Philippines.
And that's how come. Well, thank you for the history lesson.
There you go.
I never heard that one.
Me either.
Well, thank you again so much for joining me and talking a little bit about this gem of the little history that we have here and that hopefully is still continuing across Louisiana or the nation anyway.
Yeah, and you know, some people might think, well, this is really silly. But, you know, this is exactly the same tradition that Jules Verne comes from and Cyrano de Bergerac and mm-hmm. so many other great French fantasy mm-hmm. Writers and composers come out of the same tradition of just launch it out there and Rabelais, just launch it out there and see what flies and what doesn't fly, you let it settle. But what flies, you catch it and make a great story out
Run
of it.
Run with it, know? Yeah. It's good.
Interestingly, in Mamou, what we had access to was the very first stage, the very first conceptualizing stages of that amazing creative process.
Yeah, it's amazing. Well, thank you for sharing that today. And don't forget, if you are free Tuesday night, this coming Tuesday, go out to Vermilionville to hear the talk about cooking with beer. It's at Vermilionville, presented by the Center for Louisiana Studies. It'll be at 6:30.
And it features the Angels, right?
I'm actually not sure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You probably know more about it than I do. But your in-laws, the Angels? Okay.
The Brobridge Angels.
Okay. So it should be really good, really interesting. And
we're going to see how much beer makes it into the pot.
Yeah. It'll be fun. Y'all go ahead.
There'll be a lot of competition between recipe and consumption.
Go try some food. And you've been listening to Encore here on KRVS. Encore plays every Saturday at 7 a.m. and Sunday at 3 p.m. Don't forget to check the website for podcasts and playlists of your locally produced programs. And we're going to go out on a story about Pascal Zigretz, and then we'll listen to one of Charivari's songs that they wrote about him. Thank you again, Barry. We'll see you next time.
Sure thing.
I like the one he told. One he said they had Pascal and Olid. They were neighbors with each other, and they used to fight over their animals and their, you know, their like because Pascal he had about 12 acres of sweet potato, and Olid he had some pigs, and Olid would let his pigs go out at night. At night, he'd open the gate, and the pigs would go all over. And they would come into Pascal's sweet potato patch, and they would trample all his potatoes, and they'd dig them up and eat them. And Pascal would get mad. You know, he'd wake up the next morning, all his potatoes were dug up and half-eaten, and it was Olid's pigs, you know. So Olid had some sweet potatoes, too. And the pigs wouldn't mess with his. They'd come to Pascal's. But Pascal, he was so poor, instead of some chickens, he had some cigarettes. And so he would let his cigarettes go out at night.
It doesn't do any good to raise cigarettes if you like drumsticks.
But he would let them go out at night. And so to revenge himself, you know, from what Olid had done, he would let his cigarettes go in Olid's sweet potato patch, and they would beque all his potatoes.
They have their long beaks.
Their long, long beaks. And they would peck all his potatoes and ruin his potato patch. So it was like a potato war going on here, you know. So Olid, he was pretty smart, Olid. So he said, all right, you wanna do that? You want to send your cigarettes with the long beaks in my field? He said, so he dug, he replanted his potatoes, but this time he put over a foot of dirt extra over the potatoes. So Pascal's cigarettes couldn't peck them.
Because their beaks weren't that long.
Yeah, they're about that long, you know. And they couldn't peck through and ruin his potatoes. But Pascal, he was smart too. And so what he did, he tied some extensions on their beaks. Some little sticks. And the next day, they were pecking that potato over a foot deep in the ground.
There you go.
Yeah.
It worked.
It was, yeah.
Patates, castombi, olhe, conhece, quarta, prepare, conversa, patata, vete, tá, Pascal, ele é de porra.